You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, July 27th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
We're recording on Monday because we have Nexus this weekend, so I got to get the show done before Nexus. We have the game show Friday night and then a full day of conference on Saturday. But by the time you hear this, it'll probably be over. Or else it'll be halfway over.
It'll be too late.
Yeah. But I hope it's going well during the conference. So, Kara, you're still in Scotland.
Yeah, I'll be here for 6 weeks total.
Spreading disease around the Highlands.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Really? That's
wow. Make sure you have an adult with you.
Right. That's what two whole emailers have accused me of so far.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it, though. I get the instinctual, like, don't, you know, it's like practice what you preach. Like, why are you doing that? Like, and everybody talks about essential versus non-essential. Somehow nobody defines what that means, though. I don't know. What is essential travel, by the way?
You know, necessary for work or health.
What kind of travel would be necessary for health?
You have to go someplace to get
mental
operation.
Right. Okay. And we know that that's not the only kind of travel that's happening right now. Yeah.
Of course not.
You have to get home. They consider getting home essential.
Yeah.
Travel.
Getting home, I know, is considered essential. But it's tough, right? Like, I'm not in the EU. The EU is close to the US. I am in the UK, which unfortunately is no longer part of the EU. The UK is not close to the US. I followed all available precautions. I'm under quarantine. I've checked in with the NHS.
And you got tested before you left.
Yeah. And I got tested before I left. So I had a clean bill of health before I left.
It's
and
not like you willy-nilly jumped on a plane and went on, you know, holiday with no consideration of any of these things.
Yeah, and I wouldn't consider this holiday either. I mean, I think that's the important thing to keep in mind, too. Like, I think a lot of people love to, like, spout off. And there was a couple people on Twitter, I think, who were at first a little, like, miffed, and then they were kind of understanding where they were like, oh, you know, like, what are you doing there? And I'm like, do you live alone? You know what I mean? Is you're like, is the person that you are with, like, in your house with you right now? Are you quarantined together? Or did they live halfway across the country? Because that's a hard thing, too. I think we often don't talk about the psychological ramifications of the ongoing pandemic. We only talk about, like, the biological difficulties, right? And I've been very lucky that I've been, like, fully quarantined in LA this whole time. I just don't contact people. I don't even have to go to grocery stores and stuff like a lot of people do, which is essential because I, you know, I live in LA. I have Instacart. I can get things delivered. I can get Postmates. And so I think it's hard because everybody, it's very easy to judge everybody else's situation without taking into account, like, a little bit, I think, of, like, empathy and humanity. And it's kind of like, I'm doing my part. And I'm following all the necessary precautions. And sure, I wouldn't do this willy-nilly, like you said. I don't want to have to do it. But now is the right time for me. And it's, I mean, I joke sometimes I'm flippant online when people are like, business or pleasure? And I'm like, escape from America? But yeah. Like, that's obviously me being tongue-in-cheek.
Some encouraging news. There was a study published recently in Nature where they just looked at 21 existing drugs and they assayed them for potential activity against COVID-19, looking at biopsies from infected, you know, lungs from infected people with COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And they found, you know, some that are, of the ones, I'm sorry, looked at 100 different drugs, and of those, 21 showed some effective benefits against COVID-19 at concentrations that are doable. Four of them were found to work synergistically with remdesivir, which is, you know, currently the only thing that's really available that's proven. Some of them are already FDA approved. Others are already being studied for other things. You know, I think it's possible within, you know, 4 to 6 months, we could have a cocktail of medications, you know, drugs that could be effective at really slowing down this disease and improving survival, reducing the number of days you have to spend in the hospital, you know, all things that are good. So, you know, the science progresses forward.
Yeah, that's on top of the positive, at least so far, the positive looking momentum towards a vaccine as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the vaccine progress is still looking very encouraging. But on the downside, you know, there was a bunch of antibody studies that were recently reviewed, and they found that if you have, like, asymptomatic or mild exposure, you know, to SARS-CoV-2, but don't develop like full-blown COVID-19 or only a very mild case, you basically don't form antibodies, you know?
Really?
Or then the ones that you do are very short-lived. And even if you have severe illness, those antibodies don't last for very long, you know, like months, 3 months, and then they start to fade.
Is that consistent with how other viruses operate?
So viruses are very different. It's consistent with other coronaviruses, which as a group tend not to form long-lasting antibodies.
Right. That's why you can get, well, it's one of the types of the common cold, but that would be why you could get a common cold, you know.
Over and over.
Yeah, over and over.
Right.
Yeah. Remember, there's other parts of the immune system. There's the cellular immunity, the T-cell immunity. And so it seems like the immune system clears the SARS-CoV-2 more with that, with the innate cellular immunity. But that's not the part of the immune system that has the memory antibodies, you know?
Right, because if somebody is asymptomatic or low symptomatic, that means that they still contracted it, but they didn't get that sick. So obviously their immune system is doing something.
So here's the bottom line of all of that. This means that it's not true that because there's lots of potentially asymptomatic people out there who were exposed, that as a population we're becoming resistant. Those people do not have any long-lasting or significant resistance to COVID-19. It also means that this pandemic is probably not going to burn itself out. You know, by the time it comes around again, you know, any immunity from the last wave will have faded, right?
Right.
So natural immunity isn't going to do it. We have to shut it down through, you know, distancing, lockdown, and sanitation measures. And also, you know, getting back to normal, this is now what like Fauci and experts are saying. Yeah, like we're not going to get back to normal, it looks like, until we have a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Because until then, there's not going to be enough resistance in the community to sort of, for that to shut down spread of the virus. So we can't just wait it out. You know, we need the science, we need the vaccines, you know, to really knock this back.
And so it's seeming like this is going to be just kind of like endemic, like it's just going to be in the population all the time.
Yeah, just like a lot of things, like the flu, et cetera.
Which we're used to. We're used to living with those kinds of diseases when we have good treatment and especially, like you said, a vaccine. But when neither of those things are in place, that's why it looks the way it does.
Yeah. So the flu is endemic because it's so many different strains, right? It rapidly mutates. There's lots of different strains. So by the time it comes around again, there's a different strain. This virus may become endemic because the immunity doesn't last that long. So by the time it comes around again, your immunity has faded, even if it has not mutated.
Right.
But still, so, it results in the same kind of thing where it could be self-sustaining, you know.
Do we know if the vaccines that are being developed are... I know that I read somewhere that we're probably looking at multiple inoculations, like they were hoping to find a single shot, but it's just not going to work that way. But do we know if it's probably going to be like a seasonal vaccine, kind of like we have to do with the flu?
They're hoping it's going to last a year.
A whole year.
Like, that's the hope, that you'll get two doses 1 month apart and you'll be good for one season, 1 year. And then if that's the case, then we could basically sync distribution with the flu vaccine, and you either get both or they even combine them if that's possible.
But I don't get, first of all, I don't understand what's special about COVID that makes it so when you get it, you don't have like the typical longer lasting antibodies. That's my first question.
It all depends on how it interacts with your immune system. And so you don't have one immune system. You have many components to your immune system. Your immune system will knock out an infection with whatever tool it has that fits the best, you know. And, of course, organisms are always trying to find ways to evade the immune system and trick the immune system and suppress the immune system in order to get around it, right? So it just depends. Some viruses, you know, just are good at or evading or inhibiting certain aspects of immunity. At the end of the day, you know, what's the end result? The end result may or may not involve producing lots of neutralizing antibodies. And again, yeah, those antibodies can survive for various amount of time. You know,
I think
can't you just get a dose of antibodies? Could you just redose yourself with the antibodies every 6 months?
like there's an like there's something called normal when it comes to viruses, because we're so, it's sort of like a sampling bias. We're used to thinking of like smallpox or you know,
measles
or something, like, oh, but those are viruses. But look at HIV. Look at, there's a lot of different kinds of viruses that act differently. And that's why some of them we can't even come up with vaccines for. And others we have to do seasonal courses, and others they affect our immune systems in wildly different ways.
Yeah.
But we've never had a vaccine for a coronavirus. This would be the first one ever.
Yeah.
So this is my more important question is, why would the vaccine work better and be longer lasting than our own body's immune system?
Because you can design the vaccine to maximally stimulate your immune system. And, you know, again, you can give multiple doses spaced optimally to again augment that triggering, and you can give adjuvants which further increase your immune system's reaction to those viruses. So we're tweaking the immune system in multiple ways that an infection just doesn't do. And you know, for you to get this kind of exposure to the antigens, you may require like a near fatal infection. You know, we're sort of giving you the most extensive exposure you can get, but without the actual risk of an infection. So we'll see. I mean, what if it only lasts 6 months? You know, then we're going to get twice a year, or what if it only lasts 3 months? We're going to get four times a year. It's going to be a distribution and manufacturing problem at that point.
What about antibody boosters?
What do you mean?
I mean, if the antibodies don't last that long, say you get a shot in the fall, could you get an antibody booster in the spring to hold you off until the
That's another shot.
Yeah, it's just a vaccine, right?
Yeah, but isolating antibodies from people who are sick and then, you know, distilling that and then injecting that, that's different.
Yeah, that's
from
different.
Vaccine.
That's giving gamma globin.
That's what I'm talking about.
But that's only good when somebody's got an active infection. Yeah. Like, you don't really, that's not going to be preventive. Like, we're only doing that for people who are super sick.
Right, exactly. So first of all, that's limited because you have to get it from convalescent, you know, patients, people who have been really sick. And they only last a certain amount of time, a few months. Mm. And it's only, you mainly were reserving those for people who are really sick.
Okay.
So that's not going to be an option.
Yeah, it's going to last as long as native immunity lasts, right? Because that's the whole point. Yeah, which is obviously the problem, is that we're not able to make it. But I've also been reading, and Steve, I'd love to hear your take on this because you've probably dug into it more, that we shouldn't be so quick to believe, like we should be skeptical of the handful of cases where people are reporting that they've been reinfected.
Yeah, I don't know if that's proven yet. And it's most of the initial cases where that was claimed, it turned out to be false positive. Like they never had it the first time and they got it. Or the second time was a false positive. They didn't really get it again.
Or they just had a really long course. Like they actually didn't clear the virus yet.
Right. But also that was early on in the course of the disease. Mm-hmm. So now that it's been a few months, we could start be seeing people getting their second round of it if they got it 4 months ago. And their immunity is faded enough now they could get it again.
But yeah, so far everything that I've read says like, let's be cautious around these claims because we haven't really seen any good evidence to support them.
It'd be nice if we don't see that, because that will tell us something.
Right.
But we're just getting to the point now where we should start to see reinfections. The number's really quick. Worldwide, 16.6 million cases, 655,000 deaths. So it's still accelerating, right? It's still... Of course, the cumulative numbers are going up, but the number of new cases are going up. We're in the U.S., we're at least 144,000 deaths, at least 4.2 million cases. You know, obviously, the real number is almost certainly bigger than that. Many states are still on the upswing, although some of those that were really bad are starting. They're getting over their peak now. We're still very much in the middle of this wave, you know?
Yeah.
Did you guys hear about Vietnam?
Yeah, sure. I know all about
it. I've heard of Vietnam.
95 million people, not one death, one person has died.
Why?
And the number of people, first off, they were prepped from, I think they experienced, you know, a lot of deaths of children from SARS a decade ago, right? So they had that mindset. And I think typically a lot of countries who did experience that, the countries that experienced it generally have done better than other countries, but they have done, I think, the best. But I mean, a lot of people are saying that the steps they took were really draconian. They were really strict, super strict. But I mean, you know, 95 million people and not one death, that was pretty amazing.
I mean, well, it's almost it's moderately unbelievable to be.
Yeah, well, right.
But is
I agree.
It, though? That's the thing. Like, I mean, no deaths, yes. But if you think about even SARS and MERS, which are similarly infectious, I think even more fatal. And obviously, there are a lot of different factors that go into epidemiology. But like, they didn't spread the way that SARS-CoV-2 has spread. And I think a lot of people point to the fact that the reason they didn't spread globally that way is because a lot of countries just effed this up. We just didn't do the right things. And that's the thing, like, even going back to flying, right? Like, yes, it's like we need to lock down when lockdown measures need to be in place. And when we are in areas where we need to be close, it seems like if you mask up and you use proper hygiene, the infection rate just is decimated. But there are places where people aren't masking up and they're not using proper hygiene.
Even better than decimation. Here's an article I just saw here. The title is Vietnam Lauded for Coronavirus Fight Has First Local Case in 100 Days. Yeah. First one in 100 days. It just shows you what's possible.
In Hong Kong, they'll have like 3 cases and they'll like lock down again.
Yes.
Like you're seeing this in a lot of places.
Yeah, but they're
all right, let's
very
move on
open.
To some news items because Carrie, you're going to start with a COVID-19 news item about I love this paper. I read this paper like, oh my God, this is paper claiming that 5G causes COVID-19. Like, causes COVID-19.
Right. So, Steve,
oh my gosh.
I read this paper too. And I mean, maybe you could explain it to me. It's such garbage. It's like almost incomprehensible. So, I'll try and get to the top things. What I can't do is I can't systematically go through this paper and debunk it, like claim by claim, because the claims aren't even claims. Like, there's no data in it. It's just, this is an amazing piece of pseudoscience of just like the poorest. I don't even know what we'll call it, pseudoscience. I think that's probably the best term for it.
What journal would print a paper?
Right. Like we're going to talk about all of that. So we might have thrown. I think we bandied this around. Like we mentioned that there was an article, a peer quote unquote peer reviewed article that was published linking COVID-19 to 5G, and then I want to say it was last week while we were recording when I was like, oh, I just looked it up on PubMed and it was withdrawn. And so that's kind of the new development. Retraction Watch wrote a great, very succinct article about the paper being withdrawn. I don't even know if I want to use the word retracted because they're not using that terminology, which is actually problematic.
Because it was ahead of print.
Right. Okay. Uh-huh. Gotcha. So it was withdrawn
accepted,
before it was even.
And then the acceptance was withdrawn. It wasn't published, so they didn't have to retract it.
Yeah, but that's kind of the problem with preprints, right? Everybody can still read it, like on the Wayback Machine. So let's talk about the article first. I actually have the full text right in front of me. It is called 5G Technology and Induction of Coronavirus in Skin Cells. And we'll go through all the different authors in a minute, but basically it was published by a group out of Italy, an author out of the USA, and an author out of Moscow State Medical University. And they all come from, not all, but many of them come from different fields. Okay, so this is their central claim. I just have to read a couple sentences verbatim because they're that amazing. In this research, we show that 5G millimeter waves could be absorbed by dermatologic cells acting like antennas, transferred to other cells, and play the main role in producing coronaviruses in biological cells. Okay?
Got that?
So, yeah. I love this one. DNA is built from charged electrons and atoms and has an inductor-like structure. And then they talk about how these are hexagonal and pentagonal bases that for some reason produce holes when 5 millimeter or 5G millimeter waves pass through. They don't show that this happens. They don't provide any evidence that this happens, but they claim that this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say these bases, I guess, to fill the holes, the bases could join to each other and form virus-like structures such as coronaviruses.
You know what their conclusion was, Kara? All your base are belong to us.
Nice.
So, and
actually, that makes more sense than what they're talking about.
No, my gosh, it makes no sense. And it seems like their central thesis is literally this, that because 5G millimeter waves are small enough that they are smaller than an actual cell themselves, that information alone says that all this weird stuff could happen downstream. Because they're smaller than the cell, that means they can penetrate the cell membrane, which means that they can rip holes in the DNA bases, which means that the DNA bases can rearrange themselves magically into a coronavirus. I mean,
tons of things that are smaller than cells.
It makes literally no sense, Evan. It makes no sense. And so they're focusing specifically on dermatologic cells. One of their authors is from the Department of Dermatology and Venereology in Russia. And then they also focus specifically on 5G. And why they choose COVID-19? Well, my guess is that because that would make people read the paper.
Yeah.
My guess is, and there's some good evidence to support that in a minute too, the paper is also full of really fun, I guess, schematics that are pointless, like weird Microsoft Paint arrows and pictures of waves and then pictures of cells, and then just the cells are circled and they're like antenna. They just draw like a Microsoft Paint antenna outside of it.
That sounds so good. Kara, that sounds like when Trump made the hurricane map, he like used a Sharpie to extend where the... Yeah.
These are amazing. So it's like, figure one, some waves in 5G technology could be taken by dermatologic antennas. However, radio waves cannot pass the skin cells. So this is apparently supposed to bolster their argument because 5G waves are small. They can cause coronavirus. Radio waves are big. That's why we don't get coronavirus from radio waves. Then there's a material and methods, which I don't really understand because they don't do any experiments. There's literally no experimentation, so there's no data to analyze. But their materials and methods and then their results is just incomprehensible math equations.
Yeah.
It's just tons of equations that I think they literally thought, this looks really interesting. It's going to scare people off from trying to dig into it any deeper because most people are going to say, I don't understand what this means. And they'll just say, ooh, these people look smart. I'm going to approve this paper.
They just threw up a wall of math.
It's just a wall of math.
You know what this sounds like to me? One of these hoaxes where they
come
up with something so ridiculous just to see if any journal anywhere will try
it. It's that bad.
It's that bad.
This is a hoax.
And you would think so, but for a few things that I'm going to point out in a second. My favorite, too, is the final figure. It's a graph. It's like a sinoid kind of wave, like an S wave. Uh-huh. And it says, figure six, the probability of the effect of waves on the evolutions of a DNA within a cell in terms of wavelength. Okay, I don't even know what that means. There's no title. And the y-axis just says probability. And it goes from 0 to 1/2. Of something, I don't know.
Of something.
And then the wave, the x-axis.
The probability is half.
50%,
Kara. Yeah.
Right.
50%.
The x-axis is the wavelength. Yeah, 50% of what, though? Of all probabilities? I don't understand. Like, you still need a denominator.
It's ambiguous.
And then wavelength is from 0/1 to, a very small wavelength. And then it just kind of, like, shows a little curve. Like, we're just supposed to take it on faith that the smaller the wavelength, the higher the probability of waves on the evolutions of a DNA within a cell. What? And then,
Kara, like we know, as you said recently on the show, that if you throw a graph next to your claim, people believe it more.
Exactly. Yes. It's like, look, data. I have data. And then we've got this great response from James Heathers. I love James Heathers. So this is, let me just read you his bio on Twitter. A failed research scientist, biosignals, metascience, error detection. Yelling has vitamins. I love it.
Oh, wow.
Yelling has vitamins. Shallow thought leader. So this guy is really good at like ripping apart bad papers. And he... The best, I think, tweet on this is that in the paper they cite this assertion, no lie, 5G causes 720 factorial different diseases in human beings.
How many factorial?
Yes.
Wow. That's
Bob,
720 times 719 times 718.
That's a big number.
17,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. Different diseases in human beings and can kill everything that lives except some forms of microorganisms. And then we have James Heathers replying, remember, if 5G causes 720 factorial different diseases, I think there are about 13,000 diseases in the ICD-10. That's a lot less than 720 factorial, which is, and you'll like this, 2.6 times 10 to the 1,746.
Mm-hmm. So wait, Kara, what's that number mean?
Big.
Like, I'm not sure. What is that? It's more than there are atoms in the universe.
Yeah, it's 1,746 zeros.
Oh my God.
So he said
10 to the 80 atoms in the universe.
Right? As there are 10 to the 82 atoms in the universe, this might just be shite. It's amazing. So I am going to thank Elise Bick, I think is her name. She has a blog, Science Integrity Digest, where she tries her best to rip apart this article, but it's kind of difficult to do because there's, you know, no good data in it to rip apart. But she
focuses... It's like, because magic, you know, there's not much you can say about it.
let's debunk Harry Potter, okay? What?
But she does a couple really good kind of sleuthy things. One, she talks about the journal itself. So here's to answer some of the questions that were raised at the beginning. So the journal, this is the part that, I mean, pisses her off and honestly really pisses me off. This is what makes us go from like giggling about this to being like, this is actually a serious problem. The journal is called the Journal of Biological Regulators and Homeostatic Agents. They claim that they are fully peer-reviewed and they are included in PubMed, which is a problem. They're indexed in NCBI. That doesn't mean it's a strong journal, but it still means that there's an additional stamp of approval there. It's a little worrisome when you first look at the website, the Journal of Biological Regulators and Homeostatic Agents, because it says submissions are easy. No registration, no password, no papers to be filled out. Just send the manuscript to the editor-in-chief, and it gives you the editor-in-chief's contact. It's a super weird website.
With a check made out to cash.
Right, exactly. The editorial board, this part is really worrisome. If you click on the part where it talks about the editorial board on the website, it's actually a screen grab of a piece of paper. It's like a scanned piece of paper. And at least three of the people on it are dead.
Mm. Oh.
So yeah, there's just a lot of problems as you dig deeper and deeper and deeper. This is why, A, I love, love, love outlets like Retraction Watch. They're so important. Their tagline, and I've mentioned this before on the show, is tracking retractions as a window into the scientific process. This is good science. It's holding other scientists accountable. Totally. It's so necessary. It's so important.
It's necessary.
They also have a running list of all of the corona. There have been 26 papers about COVID-19 that have been retracted or withdrawn. So you can click through to that and you can read about some of those as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a ridiculous paper. It never should have been made it into preprint. It's horrific that people are able to use this now to cite and spew their pseudoscience and say, hey, look, this is legitimate. Because as we know, it's like we know from Wakefield, right? The original claim is the one that travels around the world. The retraction doesn't get heard very much.
Yeah, and it completely destroys any reputation this journal had.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's done.
Totally.
yeah, it's rough.
They're officially a rag. Mm-hmm. I mean, they did the right thing by withdrawing it, but it's like, yeah, too late. That paper got through your editorial process. You're worthless.
That got through the front
also,
door.
They only withdrew it because it got so. I mean, it was probably this and like the bikini researcher paper where like the male physicians like looked into the private lives of female physicians and were like, they're inappropriate, they're drinking alcohol and wearing bikinis. Yeah, that one's been withdrawn too, so look into that. It's a whole separate thing, but those two I think have gotten the most press and the most pushback in the last several months. So #MedBikini, just read about that on Twitter.
The most outrageous stuff gets the biggest press.
But of course that means, I mean, they didn't retract it or withdraw it until that happened. It probably would have gone untouched if people weren't like, this is an outrage. Cannot leave this. And maybe now PubMed will, think twice about including them in their
searchable database.
They
should review their listing. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. No, PubMed has holes in it as well.
Yeah, totally. We know that because we see like homeopathy papers and acupuncture. Yeah, a lot of stuff there.
Cool. What they do is like if you want to publish a homeopathy journal, they give it to homeopaths to tell them if it's legit.
Great.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like putting our bankers on our regulatory boards. I think that's called a conflict of interest.
Something
a little bit.
Foxes and hens.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, tell us how NASA is going to get us to Mars.
Yeah, I was perusing the NASA website and I was looking in the space technology section. I thought it'd be fun to discuss the technology that they think will be critical to make any Mars settlement a success. Now, the development of the technology they discuss is already happening in some cases, or really in every case, but some are pretty mature. Others are still years away. And this is all in anticipation of a potentially crewed Mars mission as early as the 2030s, which I don't think is realistic at all. But yeah, we'll get there eventually, but 10 years? No. So let's see. So my first thought when reading this was, Mars, come on, do we need to focus on the moon? Which we've said on the show many times, but then I read something on their site that calmed me down a little bit. They specifically say many of the capabilities will be demonstrated at the moon first during the Artemis missions, while other systems are more uniquely suited for deeper space. Okay, so that's fine. So the first one they mentioned was powerful propulsion systems. And yeah, this is clearly key, and more so for Mars than the moon, obviously, because the moon is, you know, it could take 3 days to get there, you know, BFD, not a huge deal compared to the, you know, the months to get to Mars. NASA describes on their site various options, including the two basic types that use nuclear fission, nuclear electric propulsion, and nuclear thermal propulsion. I discussed thermal propulsion in episode 738 fairly recently, so go there if you want a little bit more detail. The nuclear electric propulsion is different, and I thought maybe I could spend a minute on it. This kind of propulsion uses the heat from nuclear energy to create electricity instead of heating, say, liquid hydrogen. That electricity can then be used to make high-velocity ions to create an ion thruster. Now, many of you know we already have ion thrusters now, but they're obviously, you know, not creating those ions using nuclear power yet. Anyway, nuclear electric is quite a bit more efficient. That's the huge takeaway from that type of propulsion. It's 10 to 20 times more efficient than, say, your classic liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen chemical rocket. You know, an order of magnitude, that's pretty big. This efficiency is starkly shown if you look at its specific impulse, which I mentioned in that previous episode. That's basically a measure of propulsion efficiency. Hydrogen and liquid oxygen is about 450 seconds. Nuclear thermal is 900. Nuclear electric is, I've seen numbers between 3,000 and 6,000. So yeah, crazy, crazy efficient. The big downside, of course, is that the amount of thrust really sucks. Not literally, of course. It's often compared to the force of a piece of paper on your hand. But of course, it does build up. And eventually, it can be quite impressive if you're going to wait. My take on this is that nuclear thermal is probably the one that we're going to go with first, especially since DARPA's working on it and investing millions of dollars, which is awesome. Farther down the line, I've seen some ideas for nuclear electric propulsion, which seem to be pretty feasible for human space transport as well, although I haven't taken a super deep dive. One researcher was talking about it. His takeaway was that basically for the super heavy payloads you typically involved with humans, the fuel that you would need for chemical rockets and even nuclear thermal to a certain extent become just way, way too much. And I think he thinks that it will drive people to develop nuclear electric propulsion because the amount of fuel that's required for that is far, far less than the other two. The next bit of Mars tech they discussed was a Martian home and lab on wheels. So this is a planetary rover like the moon rover, but on steroids. And when I think of a rover, a planetary rover that's designed for people, I can't help but think of what? Which one? The rover from Lost in Space, right? Who remembers the name? Who remembers the name of that?
Oh, the...
Say it, yeah. Say it. Yes, the Chariot. You're right, Steve.
Chariot.
Yes, it's such an iconic vehicle. It's such an iconic vehicle. It's just so beautiful. I'm looking at my little model of it right now. I keep it by my computer. It's just so cool. And I just bet some engineers at NASA are thinking of the Chariot as well as they design their Mars version, which will be a pressurized rover. The astronauts would have everything that they need in there for weeks at a time: food, water, air. And a million other things that they would need. It's supposed to be, or it will be, very comfortable. Apparently, they will be able to wear jeans and T-shirts inside.
Nice.
The website says that they will be able to go, quote unquote, tens of miles from their surface launch craft. And tens of miles, that sounded a little lame. Like, tens of miles? Really? That's as far as it can go? Couldn't they have said like dozens? That would have sounded a little bit better than tens. But still, you know, 60
20 to 30,
you know, 50, 60, 70 miles. Yeah, I guess that is pretty significant to go, at least to go away from like your habitat, you know, your home, your home base. They will even be able to do EVAs with spacesuits as needed as well. If they want to go out and study anything or grab some rock or whatever to bring inside to the many labs that will also be on this Mars Chariot. Let's see, uninterrupted power is another big one. You know, you think, oh, solar is going to be is so helpful, and it is in lots of instances, and even in space. But on Mars, it's definitely not ideal, right? Because there's day and night cycle on Mars. Obviously, there's also those pesky dust storms that could last for months. Can you imagine? Yeah, you've got cloud cover essentially for the next 3 months, so your solar roof tiles are not going to be helping you too much. So if you want something reliable, nuclear fission is hard to beat. And this is they're far along the path with this. It's already been tested and shown to be safe and efficient and powerful enough for long missions on the moon. The ones they wanted to develop had to last at least 10 years and 10 kilowatts uninterrupted. That 10 kilowatts actually is not that much if you compare it to like a typical household, which requires 11,000 kilowatt hours a year. But their design is meant to be linked together. So you could have 5, 10, or more of these linked together, which would be plenty, you know, for any type of, any long-term moon mission. NASA's planning to demo this fission power system on the moon first. And I really, really want one for my house. Or maybe four, maybe four yeah. or five. One of the last ones they discussed was laser communications to send more information home. This is another bit of NASA tech that they're seriously considering. And you may not have heard about this one, but so they use the laser communications from Mars to Earth. And from what I've read, using lasers rather than the current radio transmissions would be a huge, huge improvement in bandwidth, comparable to going from dial-up to cable modems. Guys, I'm sure you remember that day when you first used your new cable modem.
Sure.
And,
oh, my God.
And you downloaded, what should I call it? Let's call it a huge PDF file. Remember what a game changer that was? That was fantastic. So to give you an idea of what kind of improvement this is, sending a really detailed map of Mars to Earth would take apparently 9 years with current radio systems. 9 years. Oh. Laser comms could do it in 9 weeks. So that's definitely a gargantuan improvement, although I would not want to wait 9 weeks to download my PDF. Let's see, what else can they do with the laser comms? Of course, it seems pretty obvious, I guess. They could send high-definition images and video feeds, and they can communicate with the human Martians that would now be living there. That would be a huge improvement. Let's see, let's discuss some of the things NASA did not have in this particular website.
Shielding.
What kind of shielding would they use in their habitats? Because the magnetosphere around Mars is pretty damn lame, pretty spotty.
They'd have to use a ring.
Bring a magnetosphere with you.
There's lots of potential solutions, but I don't see a lot of research going into lots of different options. Mm. So, but I was thinking more of robot help, which is a classic failure of many sci-fi movies. You know, it's like, oh, it's 200 years in the future, let's have an away team. And you go, and the away team has like no robotic help. I mean, wouldn't you have at least a few robots with you? Or how about thousands of tiny ones? Or, I mean, it's just the classic obvious thing that, like, and like nanotech too, I think, like, it, for sci-fi, they just, it just, it's such a game changer that they just like cut it out of their screenplays.
The only one who got it right was in Star Wars when Vader launched all those Imperial probes all over the galaxy.
Yeah, right.
Galaxy
and see,
to find
they also have droids.
He got some good intel.
Yeah.
That's true. More so than a lot of other sci-fi. So, self-sufficiency is another one. Self-sufficiency is critical. I mean, it's like, oh, I need this stuff from Earth. Okay, you'll have that in about a year or whatever.
Amazon Mars.
Yeah, I mean, you're on Mars. You could take advantage of your environment. You could get oxygen and rocket fuel that can be harvested from the Martian very thin atmosphere. How great would that be? Or water. Did you know that Martian dirt, is it regolith? What do they call it on Mars?
Yeah, it's still regolith.
Okay, 5% water by weight at the equator. And if you look at the Arctic regions, 60% water by weight. You know, so we could actually send systems to the moon to start pulling water out. I mean, ideally, right, you'd send robotic systems that could set things up
to Mars, and when you get there,
when you get there, oh, look, there's oxygen, here's rocket fuel, and here's water all ready for you. I mean, that kind of prep, I think, would be great, but I don't think they're gonna do that. But those are the things that I think they should be working on. But otherwise, the things that they are working on are still pretty cool too.
So do we have a timeline? Like, does NASA say, like, all things considered, this is when we expect to have boots on Mars? Are they talking in that kind of way?
Well, they're planning. Like I said, they're planning for as early as the 2030s, which I think is so overly optimistic. So Yeah, I think what they say is almost irrelevant. It's just like, yeah, if they think they could do it as early as the 2030s, it'll probably happen in the 2050s in my book.
So it's
my
aspirational.
Book. Yeah.
I'm sure we'll be talking about this more. And, of course, we have the new Mars rover that it will be looking, you know, specifically looking for evidence of life on Mars. So, you know, that was something we've been talking about a lot as well. And, yeah, we have no idea at this point.
And who knows what could happen. Steve, like a big discovery. If they make a big discovery on Mars, I think that could accelerate. I think that could accelerate the entire process. Obviously,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that would put life into it.
Yeah, probably.
Nice.
All right, so one quick one for me. I've talked about this kind of thing before, but there's this is a whole issue of using prayer instead of medicine, and of course, this is not to talk about people's personal religious, you know, convictions, but. When you substitute your personal beliefs for basic standard medical care, you know, then it's problematic. Whereas you could do anything for yourself. Anybody, any adult, competent, you know, individual can refuse treatment for whatever reason they want. But when you're doing it on behalf of somebody else, then the state has a vested interest in that, right? So this is the news item here is an Alaska Supreme Court decision, which reaffirmed a lower court decision. Where essentially a daughter, they're using pseudonyms, but the daughter named Rachel was taking care of the primary caregiver of her mother, Tiffany. Her mother had epilepsy and other diseases and basically wasn't able to take care of herself. The daughter decided that she was going to use prayer alone to manage her mother's medical conditions and not any medicine. And, you know, if you read the actual decision, there's a lot of details in there, including the fact that, you know, the daughter of the caregiver, Rachel, is like a little paranoid, perhaps a little unbalanced herself. So the court basically reaffirmed that prayer is not medicine and that no, you cannot substitute your prayers for basic medical care. So that may seem obvious, but it's actually a really important legal precedent and legal decision. So the court said, we affirm religious freedom. However, the state has a compelling interest in this case, that interest being the protection of Tiffany, of a citizen. Let me read you a quote from the actual decision. This kind of sums it up. They say in the decision, in this case, while Rachel is Tiffany's daughter and cared for Tiffany as her guardian for several years, the Superior Court correctly noted that Rachel's beliefs and behaviors constituted a barrier to Tiffany getting her needs met. The court pointed out that due to her condition, Tiffany needs a guardian to make objective decisions for her. The Superior Court noted that a history of family tension and Rachel's hostility bordering on paranoia toward outside entities resulted in Tiffany losing valuable services and resources to which she is entitled. So that was sort of the nub of their decision. So there's a couple of things in there that I thought were interesting. You know, to pull out, because, you know, there is in almost every state in the United States and the federal level, you guys are familiar with the principle of stare decisis, right? Which is basically the notion of precedent, that the laws need to be applied equally and with internal consistency. So if one court rules a certain way on a decision, you can cite that as precedent, that therefore they should make other decisions that are consistent with it, right? Yeah. Apparently, though, not every legal system has that principle. Some, because basically there's two, the two guiding forces are the law and precedent, right? And there's kind of a balancing act between those two things. But in the U.S., you know, our legal system is based a lot more heavily than other systems on legal precedent, which interprets a law. As opposed to like every judge being able to interpret the law for themselves. You know what I mean? So it creates more stability, even though it might lock in decisions which are not quite optimal. You know what I mean? That's the, how fluid are you going to make the legal decisions versus stable? So in any case, because of that, this is a very important precedent and for a couple of ways. You know, one, just saying that no, you know, your religious freedom ends where the care of another human being begins, right? Now, of course, we usually talk about this in the context of a parent caring for a child. And there, the courts So now you have the same setup where you have one person making medical decisions for another and desiring to substitute their own religious beliefs and practices and substitute prayer for medicine. But there's an extra layer of a parent's rights to take care of their own children or determine what's best for their own kids. And with that extra layer in there, the courts are very reluctant to go against parents and do tend, unfortunately, and I think in error, often side with the parents. Not always, but they often do. This is different. This is a daughter taking care of a mother, so there isn't that parental rights layer. And so without that layer, they were not shy in clearly stating, no, you don't have a right to deny somebody else the basic rights that they are entitled to because you decided that you'd rather pray for them than give them standard of care medicine.
Steve, look, I of course you have to write about stuff like this, but it just blows my mind that these types of things, these ideas have to be discussed, that people have to waste their time, you know, writing blog posts about stuff like this. But that's the world we live in, right? I mean, I guess that's why skeptics exist. But it really does blow my mind that, like, people would legitimately sit there and say, you know, of the few things on my list of what I could do to help my mother, I'm going to say no to all the others and sit here and pray for them. I mean, like, what's your data point? At what point did prayer ever work in the past?
Yeah, well, you know, of course we know that, but most people who are at that point believe that it does work because of, you know, confirmation bias and all kinds of other biases in their thinking. And of course, she's biased against medicine. She is quoted as saying psych meds are not from God and they never healed anybody.
That sounds a lot like
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, Tom Cruise. And
no, absolutely. Yeah. So, but the other thing here that may get that none of the media reported on that caught my eye, though, was that she has a right to medicine, not only medicine, but to care that is based upon quote unquote objective decisions. That may seem like a little thing, but that's actually critical, I think, to this decision, because it reaffirms that in order to get the services that she has a right to, it requires objective decision making. And what does that mean? So how do we objectively determine what is standard of care medicine, right? That's what that connects to. Well, through, you know, science, right? Through transparency, through ethics. And so if you throw out objectivity, then you know, you can also throw out all of those things. But here's the other thing. If you go a couple of steps from this, and again, if you're going to be internally consistent, right? A lawyer could reasonably make an argument based upon this precedent, you know, in this line. So I would argue that most of what passes for alternative medicine is basically faith healing, right? Reiki is faith healing. Homeopathy is faith healing. All of it. Anything that requires chi is faith healing. All of it. And so some of it's pseudoscience. Some of it's just really, really bad science, right? Some of it's just, you know, con artists. But some of it's just misguided, like appeal to nature fallacy. But a lot of what passes for it is really some form or another of faith healing with just other spiritual, magical, you know, superstitious beliefs sitting in for, you know, whatever your religion is. And so you could argue that therefore, like, the state should not accept, you know, any of these treatment modalities as a substitute for actual medicine. Which, of course, that's the conclusion that I'm trying to get to, right? Because which I of course have argued for from other angles previously. If you accept something like Reiki, you know, which is just sort of moving around your hands in order to fluff up the energy field, you know, it's basically laying on hands faith healing, but just with more Eastern philosophy overtones. If you accept that as a legitimate medicine, then you are basically saying that faith healing is medicine, that prayer is medicine. Mm. And if you say that prayer is not medicine, then you have to say Reiki is not medicine, right?
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the world that we live in right now. So the whole principle of stare decisis, of this sort of internal consistency, it doesn't apply if you don't connect the dots all the way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a good decision. It's an important decision. You know, I hope that it builds, you know, on this legal precedent in such a way that, you know, we have a good solid case to argue when the need comes up that, hey, you know, no, you can't deny your kid medicine because it doesn't comport with your personal religious beliefs. And no, you can't require states to pay health insurance premium, you know, health insurance costs for magic and pseudoscience and for prayer.
Right.
Yeah. So that's where it really comes down to. It's like you can't mandate coverage of prayer as medicine for all the same reasons that this decision was made.
Sure. But you could say that from a position of logic.
Yeah.
But there's no...
But that's the legal system is based on logic. Well, right.
Gotcha. But it's, you know, I'm not convinced that any profound change is going to happen in the short term.
No, but neither am I. I'm just saying this. It's good to note the legal precedent here and to note the hypocrisy and the inconsistencies that it points out, you know?
May come a date where someone's going to whip this out and it may make a difference.
Yeah, I think that's a point. Like if we're ever fighting against legislation to mandate coverage of, you know, what is essentially faith healing, this is a legal precedent that would.
Right.
So look at right here. This Alaska Supreme Court says prayer is not medicine. And, you know, people have a right to objectivity in determining what counts as medicine. And what does that mean, et cetera, et cetera. That's my point. All right, let's move on. Okay, Evan, I love it when one pseudoscientist fights against another pseudoscientist, like the battle of the fakes, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, now you're fake because of my fake reason.
Yeah, it's like a turf war almost in the realm of, you know, insanity. But yeah, this particular news item, I found this. It originated from a site called the Deccan Chronicles, Deccan Chronicle. Now, you should be familiar with the word Deccan.
Deccan I know traps. I can,
Deccan exactly, traps. Yeah, Deccan man. Traps. Thank
Flood
you very
basalt.
Much. Yep, one of the largest volcanic features on the planet. It's a big
yes. Be very happy that they don't happen now or in. While humans are alive, because they are the scariest eruptions you could ever imagine.
Oh gosh!
Like yes, I'm going to erupt. Wait, let me describe it. I forget it. I don't want to take.
but we're talking about India because that's where the Deccan traps lie. So this is an online newspaper from India, the Deccan Chronicle. It's printed in the English language. They've been doing this for a better part of 90 years, so they've been around a while. There was an actor from Bollywood, and his name was Sushant Singh Rajput. And he was 34 years old when he died this past June 14th. By suicide is the official word. However, there are rumors that are swirling that it was instead murder.
Of course.
Or something much more, or if not murder, something more sinister. In other words, someone else had a hand in it. So a little bit on Sushant. Sushant was more than a famous Bollywood actor. Prior to his acting career, he studied engineering. He had a love for astrophysics and quantum physics. He even competed in India's physics Olympics and won at the time when he was an engineering student. So, you know, really good on him. He's so huge into science. For example, he would send out tweets regularly about the Chandrayaan 2 spacecraft, the explorer that went to the moon from India. He would talk to his fans and remind them about the differences between dark energy and dark matter. Obviously very conscious of global warming. He wasn't afraid to ask big questions on subjects where science met the fringes of science, something called panpsychics, for example, which was this universal consciousness that is supposedly present in all matter. Not that he was a proponent of it, but he just liked the idea that these were big topics being discussed. And he would look up at the moon at night and think of all the same thoughts that we would have looking up at the moon about our place in the universe and just the wonder of it all. He was even more than that. He was an entrepreneur. He founded three startup companies in a two-year span, one of which was a research facility for sustainable energy, another for artificial intelligence research. He funded trips for students to NASA. He sent over 100 kids to NASA visits and various programs. He was a spokesperson for the Women's Entrepreneurship Platform, which is an initiative in India to help women follow their entrepreneurial dreams. And he started a nonprofit to fight hunger in India. So, you know, this was a very brilliant and multi-purposed person who happened to leave the fields of engineering and science to get into acting and became very successful. In Bollywood and as an actor. He's very much an up-and-comer. So this, you know, real celebrity for a lot of reasons in India. Now, he died on, like I said, on June 14th, he was found. So it's 6 weeks since then. There's a ton of media in India right now covering this story, continues to cover it. And I've watched a dozen or so videos on YouTube about him and about how the media is treating this. There's this tension in the culture about whether he killed himself or whether he was murdered. I mean, this is a huge thing going on right now. People are demanding investigations. Actors are speaking out. Celebrities are speaking out. This big culture sort of conflict is occurring. What we know is that when, sadly, these things happen, and, you know, why are we talking about this particular story on the SGU? Because we know that when you have this kind of matter, there are those who believe in certain things, such as magic and paranormal and other ideas which have no attachment to reality, and they start to move in on this territory. And the psychics certainly have done just that. The USA has people claiming to be psychics. India has people claiming to be psychics. And when they share this common belief system, and it is a belief system, however, there are psychics in India that are furious that an American psychic from Chicago has claimed to have spoken to Sunshine in the afterlife. Mm-hmm. So this is the turf war that we were initially talking about. So Chicago-based paranormal activity expert Stephen Huff announced that he had spoken to the spirit of the actor and recorded his conversations with him because Stephen Huff, oh my gosh, this is right? The worst of the worst.
Yeah,
he claims to have this device, an electronic device in which he's turning knobs and gizmos with a big speaker that lights up. And he has this communication with a voice, basically, I guess, depending on who it is he's trying to reach. He's using this as his stage show, basically, for how he's doing it. I mean, talk about dishonoring the life and memory of this talented and brilliant person. And you got these vultures, these psychics who come in claiming to communicate with the dead. All senses of decency and humanity are out the window with these people. Forget it. It is like the Wild West, essentially. They're absolutely taking advantage of the situation. Huff claimed that he called the late actor's spirit after receiving many requests, thousands of requests from his fans, saying that they wanted him to look into this. Who knows if that's really the case or not, if he got a dozen or two calls, who knows? And again, you watch these videos of these sessions, and they are just absolutely awful. His device is called the Astral Doorway, and he claims to be able to speak to, well, just about anyone. He uses his psychic powers to sort of
An actual device?
Oh, it's a device. It is. You can watch the videos
like a
of
physical...
it. Look them up.
What does it look like?
It looks like a ham radio contraption, essentially,
mm-hmm.
with some Christmas lights that he attached to it, which flicker when a voice emanates from the speaker. And he's turning some crystallized knobs that look like the control panel from the Sleestaks in Land of the Lost. Reminded me of that. Now, so the psychics in India are all pissed off at this guy because they're claiming that he's fake and he's taking advantage of the situation and trying to, you know, put his flag in the ground or on the territory that, frankly, those in India in the paranormal communities should have preference for, because according to them, he lived in India, he died in India, that's where his spirit lives, and that's the only place that you can actually physically go to actually communicate with him, if you are going to communicate him. Some guy in Chicago halfway around the world can't do it with his gizmonotron or whatever the heck he's got. So this is...
Wait, that's the argument?
That's the argument, right. It's not...
Does anybody ask his parents what they want?
Right.
I feel like those are the only people who should have any say in whether or not a psychic... you know, public, like, talks about this.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so disrespectful. And granted, you know, I don't really know a lot about what different traditions there are, but if his parents wanted to do some sort of thing because it was in line with their belief systems, that's their right. But, like, nobody else needs to be trying to make money or, I don't even know, get notoriety based on this. It's gross.
Oh, it's morbid. It's ghoulish. It is ghoulish.
Yeah.
But this is... Well, we're not surprised by this because we've seen this before. You know, we've been doing this for decades, looking at psychics and looking at what they do and the Sylvia Browns of the world and the John Edwards and all of them. They capitalize on other people's griefs. They're grief vampires. That's exactly what they are. I think Susan Gerbic calls them that, and rightfully so. So, and Also, you go to – I looked at about a half a dozen articles online, you know, from India and elsewhere covering this story. Where's the skeptic? Hello? Where's the Indian Skeptical Society interview, yeah, part of the article saying how none of this is right and you're totally, you know, botching this on levels you're not even to realize that you're botching it and you're totally disrespecting the memory of this person.
That's the thing. Do you want some vulture psychic talking for you after you die?
Oh my gosh, no. Could you imagine?
Well, I could imagine though like who cares what that guy says as far as the content? Like anyone that matters, they wouldn't believe it anyway.
Well, that's not true though. That's the thing. Like I think, you know, when families are grieving, they might believe what somebody is selling them.
Oh yeah, you
could. Because they're, you know, even if they aren't usually susceptible to that, like credulous, you don't know, grief does weird things to people psychologically. You know, that's the gross thing. It's like, you or I, like somebody who's not related to this guy, but think about like all his fans too, that weird fanship kind of dynamic and how they might believe, like he could really sully this kid's name. He could do or say literally anything. There's no ethical code for this.
Right.
Because it's unethical.
Exactly right, Kara. They're not bound by any ethics or decency or humanity or anything else. That's what makes them the vultures that they are. And this guy, Steve Huff, with this device, and he's got 7 million hits now on his videos on YouTube.
Oh,
and that's just like in about, you know, a week or so of this having been put out there. So, you know, this is...
Yeah, it's disgusting.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
Super gross.
So that's why we're talking about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Evan. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. So, what do you think that is?
Some sort of valve?
Not a bad guess. Anybody else?
An espresso machine.
Evan, you win. So, I don't even Michael Jack wrote in. Well, first off, to all the Who's That Noisy listeners out there, don't feel bad because these guys don't know what the hell it is either.
Oh,
anyway.
Hell no.
A listener wrote in named Michael Jack, and he said, "Hi, Jay, longtime listener, first-time guesser. I'm going to say that the noisy sounds like when a nuclear.
Yep.
The will is there, Kara. It's, you know.
I know.
I'm fighting myself.
You're working on it.
When a reactor starts up, when it's submerged into its cooling pool. Hope you guys have a great week. Love the show. Thank you for all your hard work and diligence, Mike." That is a cool, that's a cool guess. I don't know what that sounds like. I've never heard it. I'd imagine that there is like an interesting sound when that incredibly hot stuff hits the water, but you're not correct, but I would like to hear that sound. You guys might have heard of this guy. You ever hear of Visto Tutti?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
about every other week we've been talking about him.
He guesses every week. He says, "Hey, Jay, I hear the gas flowing, then a flame being struck. It sounds like an oxygen acetylene torch being lit." That's actually a really good guess because I know what that sounds like, and it is kind of similar. You're not correct, but that was a good guess.
But, Jay, have you been tracking? Has Visto ever gotten one correct?
Oh, my God. You know what? I don't think he has, but he would know better than me because of just the volume.
Oh, my God.
All right. Visto, email me if you got one right just so Steve could know. You only have about 5 more months till the end of the year. You got to get one right. Stuart Faramond. Hi, guys. I'm a very long-time listener, but I'm pretty sure this is my first ever guess. This week's noise reminds me of the Leidenfrost effect, which is a very cool phenomenon. I know Bob knew that one. It's a cool phenomenon that needs to be seen to be believed. When you splash a drop of water onto a very hot metal surface above 200 degrees Celsius, such as a dry pan on a burner, the drop doesn't immediately evaporate, but floats like a miniature hovercraft over the surface of the pan, apparently buoyed up by a cushion of steam from the underside of the droplet. It makes a hissing noise when the water first hits the surface and then the blebs of water roll around on the base of the pan like little silver marbles.
Blebs.
I've done that many times.
That's a great word. Bleb.
Yeah. And I'm not hearing the similarity, but I put this in because I just thought it was a cool thing to tell everyone. But like you've seen it, but it has a name and scientists, of course, have studied it. So thanks, Stuart, for sending that guess in. Here's another longtime listener, Evil Eye. He says, love you all. It sounds like a tractor tire being inflated and snapping onto the bead. Then he wrote me back to, you know, he wanted to explain it a little bit better. He said, to inflate a huge tractor tire, they build up pressure and inflate the tire all at once so it pops out and seals instead of slowly filling it like a car. That thing would blow a hole in you. Michael Oof. Goff. Yeah, so I've seen tires inflated like this. Like, if you ever brought your tires to get professionally changed, you know, they put the tire up on the machine and they hit it with the air and the whole thing just inflates super quick, you know, and it makes all the two seals around the rim of the tire immediately engage. It's really cool. It's a very scary sound and you really don't want to be near an exploding tire.
Nope.
Hey, nobody guessed the noisy.
Ooh.
Not surprised. What is it?
All right, so Daniel Goodale Porter wrote in and said, Jay came across this sound of the implosion of a 15-inch glass sphere at 8,500 meters. And this was the recording of that sound.
Under the water?
Yeah, Challenger Deep Mariana Trench. Mm. Let's hear the sound one more time.
A glass sphere imploding.
Yep. That's, you know, a glass sphere, like, there's not a lot of space in a glass sphere. You know what I mean? It's pretty solid material. So what the hell does that look like? Anyway, I thought that was really cool. I guess you guys don't like it, but I loved it.
Well, that's cool.
Like, I want to see it. I want to see it.
Well, that's what the internet's for, my love. A new noisy this week sent in from Fred and Lynn. And here is the noisy. Sounds a little familiar in a way, but what the heck is that? What is that sound? Any guesses, guys? I'm curious.
Those are stalactites being hit with a hammer.
That is incorrect.
It's quick. Oh. You're wrong.
You're wrong, and I like it. So if you think you know what the noisy is for this week, or if you heard something cool, please do send that to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Only a very few number of listeners will be listening to this show while there's still time to register for Nexus. If you're listening to this, you know, at 1 p.m. Eastern or 2 p.m. Eastern, there's still, you know, 4 or 5 hours of Nexus left. You can go to necss.org.
Yeah, but also, Jay, they could watch it for a month. They have a month to consume the whole
Sweet.
Thing.
So you're right.
Really too late.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you might as well just sign up if you haven't, because you could watch it whenever you want.
Yeah. All right. You know, by the way, so I looked up, you know, imploding glass sphere just to see what came up. There's a lot of research papers. So apparently the reason why we have a recording of an imploding glass sphere is because they use it for hydroacoustic calibration.
Oh, so they do it deliberately to
test
equipment.
Yeah. So, like, for example, monitor the nuclear test ban. So that's a deliberate thing. There's a lot of scientific experiments where they're monitoring implosion of glass spheres at different depths for hydroacoustic research. Cool.
But why would they need to use a sphere to do it, though?
Now you're getting technical.
All right. Well, maybe I'll look it up for next week.
I just read this, Jay.
I'm just reading abstracts.
It's my curiosity, Steve. You know, I'm a skeptic. I'm curious.
All right. We have an interesting email. This one comes from Jack from the Chicago area. He doesn't want to be too specific. Just the Chicago area. And Jack writes, since I am a relatively new listener, I've been working my way through older podcasts. I just listened to podcast 117 from 2007. That interview with Dr. Mark Krislip was downright scary. I had to consciously remind myself that it was over 10 years old, which actually made it worse. If I had that kind of presentiment, it would depress the hell out of me. So he's talking about an interview that we did in 2007 with Mark Krislip. We're talking mainly about the flu and the flu vaccine, but then the discussion goes to what's going to happen when the next pandemic hits.
No
way. I don't
know
if you guys remember. This is before your time, Kara, obviously, but I don't know if you guys remember this conversation. And so I listened to it, and Mark totally nailed it, right? So first he says, it's going to happen. It's not a matter of if, but or when. These things are inevitable. They happen with on a fairly regular basis. It's going to happen. We're going to have another big, serious pandemic. How do, and then I think Jay, you said, what do we do about it? He said, well, you isolate yourself, right? You lock down. Mm-hmm. You wash your hands and you cover your mouth, right? Mm-hmm. So that's basically what we do today.
It's like, it's as if people had been researching this their entire
career. It's
careers.
As if we, all,
yeah,
we already,
if we already had guidance.
Do.
How about 1918 when these things were also supposed to know?
He did talk about that. And then he said, and you know, in worst case scenario, we'd have to actually shutter in your home for 3 to 4 months.
Right.
And then
speculated about what that would do to the economy. Mm-hmm. And he said it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be fun. So it was eerie listening to it because he was basically describing 2020.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, in reasonable detail. And this is in 2007. So we knew, right? I mean, the experts knew. He's an infectious disease expert. This is like, yeah, we're going to get hit with a pandemic. If it's bad, this is what's going to happen, you know? And it's exactly what did happen. Very interesting. But I was motivated by that to do another 5 to 10 year follow-up, right? We've been doing these 5 to 10 year follow-ups. So I did. Because I just looked at some other episodes from that similar time. And in episode 213.
Whoa.
So 213. Ooh. So this is from, so this would be from 2009, I guess, 2009. Yeah, it was 11 years ago from now. We covered a story on lithium ion batteries because we, you know, as you remember, we frequently talk about batteries. And this is one that did stick out for me. I remember covering it. So they essentially developed a new anode for lithium-ion batteries made of silicon. And they said that this anode has 10 times the efficiency as the existing anodes that we use for lithium-ion batteries. Doesn't mean that the whole battery would have 10 times the power or whatever, but it could be very, very effective. And we did a very quick follow-up, you know, after that, because of based upon feedback, I think, because there was a subsequently in that same year, there was a subsequent news item where they wrapped the silicon in carbon nanotubes.
Cool.
And that made it more stable. So I said, okay, so this was 10 years ago, 11 years ago. Is this something that's been incorporated into battery technology? Say, where is this research? Or was this a dead end? Did this go nowhere? So I found a bunch of articles, but the most recent one was from 2018, so you know just 2 years ago. Controlling surface oxides in silicon carbon nanocomposite anodes for high performance lithium ion batteries. So this technology has been developed over the last 10 years. It's still, I think, in the development phase. It looks like they're making good progress, and it's a thing. Silicon carbon nanocomposite anodes for lithium ion batteries. I don't know I couldn't find that any are in production. These are still just research papers that I'm finding, but it's interesting. So this was not a dead end. This has led to subsequent research. It looks like they're making progress, but it also shows you how long it takes for these things to work themselves out. Here we are 11 years later and it's still just being researched. You know, they're still tweaking it and incrementing it, et cetera. So like in this study, they say insights gained are important for the design of high-performance silicon carbon composite electrodes. So they're still working on it, still a work in progress, but not a dead end. This one is they're still doing. So maybe another 5 to 10 years, it'll be in your car or something.
Steve, do you think that they use the glass spheres because when they implode, they make a loud noise or something?
Probably. And they're probably very strong, right? A sphere is a very strong shape.
Yeah.
So they
can get really deep.
They can get them really deep, right? Exactly. That would be my guess. Mm.
That's cool.
Yeah. All right. You've been thinking about that the whole time?
I can't stop.
Yeah.
You know what I'd like to do? When something like that happens listening. And I don't know the answer, sometimes
well, look
I
it
like,
up. You know, you
well,
can
wait, but I'm telling you, I'm explaining to you my thought process here.
Yeah.
I like to think it through and try to reverse engineer a good reason why they would pick, you know, like in this instance, I want to know why they're doing it, but I want to try to think of it through before I look up the answer. Because
it's always a good thing to do.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, you could see where you're lacking knowledge. Like, oh, I would never have thought of that because I don't know, you know, anything about blah, you know?
Yeah, it's like I tell my residents and my medical students, decide where you think the lesion is before you look at the MRI scan. Because once you look at the MRI scan, you will make sense of it no matter what the answer is. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's like hypothesis testing. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. That way you could test your own ability to localize lesions and you get good at it very quickly. But if, once you look at the MRI, then you'll say, oh, yeah, of course that's where it is. And you can make sense of it. It's like astrology at that point. All right. Let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. Now, typically, when we do these early recordings, there hasn't been like a full week of news for me to draw from. So I typically will do like a themed science or fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm doing tonight. Okay.
All right. The theme.
The theme is... We probably have used this theme before, but I like it. I think there's so much here. The theme is insects. How much do you guys know about insects?
I mean, a lot, but there's so much more to know out there.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's so many insects. I think it's like almost like saying animals. You know, it's like there's just so much. All right, three little facts about insects. We'll see how much you guys know. Item number one, insects do not breathe through their mouths, but rather through holes in the sides of their exoskeleton. Item number two, the Antarctic continent is the only continent on Earth that does not have any native insects. And item number three, many insects, in addition to their two compound eyes, have a triangle of three simple eyes in the middle of their forehead. Bob, go first.
Yeah, don't breathe through their mouths. That's how insect respiration works, doesn't it? Yeah, I think that's right. Oh, boy. I'm fairly confident about that one. Antarctic does not have native insects. That sounds pretty damn reasonable to me. I mean, geez. But they are like everywhere. They've adapted to every damn environment. Wouldn't be surprised if there are native ones in there as well. Yep, that's a coin flip, I think, for me. Yeah, this triangle one, three simple eyes in the middle. Damn, never heard of that. Have a triangle of three simple eyes in the middle. How could I not have seen this? Yeah, I think that's probably going to be true when you're just like, yeah, I'm going to get him with that. I'm going to have to do some meta decisions. So yeah, I'll say the Antarctic continent is fiction. Wait, is that what I want to say? Yes, whatever.
Okay. All right. Evan.
Mm. Yeah, I'm leaning with Bob on this one. And the reason why I think the Antarctic continent one is going to be the fiction is, I mean, we might be talking about current day Antarctic. And its inhabitate there for insects. but a long, long time ago, that was perhaps not the case. Likely not the case. And therefore, how do you define native insect? Could there have been insects? I mean, some of these insects have been around a very long time. And there could have been a time in history, certainly, when there were some vegetation among some other things in Antarctica and would have had some insects. So that's why I think that one's the fiction. And about the exoskeleton, yeah, that reminds me of gills on fish sort of breathing through their sides, you know, and using their mouth for other things. And then the triangle of three simple eyes in the middle, the mental image I have in my head of like ants among other things is that there is some kind of thing there, but I never knew they were eyes, but there was some sort of feature that lied between the eyes. Never knowing it was these eyes, so I think that one turns out to be true.
Okay, Kara.
LGWBE. I just think that probably Antarctica has bugs, because I think there are bugs everywhere.
That's it?
Yep.
All right.
I like it.
Jay.
All right, so insects do not breathe through their mouths. The reason why insects do not breathe through their mouths is because they're not stupid. Haha, that was a little joke. No, I mean, I truly believe that insects do not breathe. Yeah, get it?
Yeah.
Wow, Kara, you don't even... It's not even... Like, you go to Scotland and, like, you lose all your American humor. It's just gone. Like, what do you laugh about now? Like, sausages or something? Like, what's funny over there? Anyway...
Yes, meat pies. It's all about the meat pies and the Highland
booze. I completely believe that insects breathe through holes in their exoskeleton. So I think that is science. The last one, about the two eyes, I also believe that is science. Now, I don't think that the Antarctic doesn't have any insects because they have to. Insects are way too prolific to not exist. They're everywhere. They're microscopic. They're just virtually everywhere. So that one is absolutely the fake.
Wow.
So you guys are all in agreement.
Oh, boy.
Very confident in your knowledge about insects.
Don't put it like that.
I'm going to take this in reverse order. Starting with number three, many insects, in addition to their two compound eyes, have a triangle of three simple eyes in the middle of their forehead. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is... I just dropped a picture on you.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Wow. Wow.
I didn't know
that one
eyes.
Is science.
I didn't know
look
those were
that.
Eyes, though. I thought they were
those
like
were eyes.
Tympanic
yeah,
membranes or something to sense vibrations.
Yeah, but you look at tons of pictures of insects, and there they are. You know, it's like yeah. we talked about this before.
Yeah. Aren't those the ones that just detect, like, if it's light or not? If they're not, like, seeing
they're
up.
Solar
they're detecting,
sensors or something.
Yeah, they're like solar sensors, right?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. And they think
lizards
that they're
have those.
They're probably for navigation and to allow them, for example, to keep oriented when they're flying crazy, when they're doing maneuvers, you know?
Interesting.
So, but they may serve different functions in different insects. But it's funny, like you think you know what insects look like and like, holy shit, there's those three eyes in between their two big eyes and like they're there. There's like, I'm looking at hundreds of pictures of insects with them there. And like, you just, it just didn't register, you know?
Well, it didn't, yeah. I knew it was. I knew that there was something there. I just didn't know what it was, and didn't think that it was eyes. I thought it was just a membrane of some kind.
That's neat. All right, let's go back to number two. The Antarctic continent is the only continent on Earth that does not have any native insects. You guys all think this one is the fiction. So let me ask you guys a question. So if there are insects in the Antarctic, how do they keep from freezing to death? These tiny little things.
Maybe they have like antifreeze, some sort of natural
exothermic situation.
They make antifreeze?
Yeah, I think a lot of animals have like some sort of natural antifreeze in their blood.
I know some mammals do, or it's like frogs do. I would just imagine that they can freeze and unfreeze.
I know we have formaldehyde, right?
I think they just ignore the cold.
They just will it away.
Well, this one is the fiction. Good work, guys.
Okay.
Yep, you are correct. In fact, and this I debated going back and forth on this one, how to make it, you know, like the science or the fiction. In fact, insects and related arthropods are the only terrestrial animals on the Antarctic continent. Mm-hmm. There are no mammals, reptiles, amphibians. The only vertebrates are birds, like penguins and stuff. There are aquatic, you know, and you know, flying animals, but they're the only terrestrial ones. And the biggest one is only like a couple of millimeters long, you know, so you can say, what's the biggest terrestrial animal on the Antarctic? Hmm. And it's this tiny little bug, but it's a Cryptopygis antarcticus, which actually that group used to be called insects, but now they're no longer categorized. They're now like a very closely related group next to the insects, but they're not true insects. They have internal mouth parts instead of external mouth parts, and there are three groups of them, and they tend to get grouped together, but in fact, it's a non-cladistic category because they're all independently evolved, and they're not any more related to each other than they are to insects. But anyway, there you have 1 to 2 millimeters long. That's it. That's the biggest terrestrial animal on Antarctica. And they do have antifreeze. Absolutely. They make antifreeze.
Oh, cool.
There you go. Yep. See?
That's it.
Nice.
That's how they survive these sub-freezing temperatures. And there's not many of them. There's not many of them in terms of absolute numbers or in numbers of species, especially compared to the other continents. And different references said different things. One reference says there are only 67 species of insects recorded in Antarctica. So that's the high number that I read, but some said even less, as opposed to the millions and millions, you know, on the other continents. Just 67. Pretty cool.
Very cool.
And this means, of course, that insects do not breathe through their mouths, but rather through holes in the sides of their exoskeleton. That is science. The whole idea of insect respiration is fascinating because they evolved a completely, obviously they're not vertebrates, they have a completely different way of getting oxygen to their tissue than vertebrates do. So they don't really even have blood. They don't have blood vessels, right? Mm-hmm. They just bathe their tissue in hemolymph.
Hemolymph.
They don't have blood pumping through vessels, right? They just sort of move this liquid around and they just move it around through muscle contractions. And then they do have like the holes in the side of their exoskeleton that they breathe through. And they have tubes, you know, that go deeper into their tissue, and then the hemolymph gets oxygen from that. But it's, you know, it's a very limited system. And that's why they say, you know, insects are basically as big as they can get based upon, you know, if they were any
oxygen
bigger,
in the atmosphere.
Couldn't get enough oxygen to the tissue. And that's why in the past, when like you had the big insects, there was a higher oxygen concentration in the atmosphere. So
it makes you wonder what the situation is like in places like Borneo, where you see some of the largest insects, mm-hmm. like the really big beetles and things like that, like why they're able to thrive there.
Yeah, but that's the limit. Like, that's as big as they can get.
Right.
So what? How do insects, aquatic insects, get their oxygen?
Oh, is it do they have, can they pull it out of the water?
Yeah.
Gills.
The same way,
They have gills.
Like little baby insect gills. I mean, because these are almost like gills.
Yeah,
right?
Or other things.
They have gills, or just they need a lot more surface area because there's a lot less oxygen in the water than there is in the air. So they have some gill-like structure, and they have, you know, they can move, like they could draw the, because they got like, the insects don't really like suck in the air. It just sort of diffuses in, but they do move it around a lot. But if you're underwater, they do need to sort of have some kind of ability to draw in and move the fluid in and out more quickly to get the as much oxygen as they can. They have to sort of optimize that process. But yeah, they're like basically living right on the edge, you know, their ability to get oxygen out of the air or the water.
Steve, I feel like this one, the insects breathing through the leg holes the exoskeleton holes, is like every so often there's a clue where I'm like, I absolutely know that that's science. Like, I absolutely.
Right.
And then as I read the other ones, I start going, maybe it was a wives' tale.
Right.
Maybe I don't know
right.
You have to question yourself.
Kara, they're more susceptible to COVID because they can absorb, because the 5Gs penetrates
exactly.
the those slots in their exoskeleton.
The air holes.
Yeah.
Slots.
So, beware.
Makes hexagonal holes.
Yeah. Pentagonal
produce
holes.
Produce coronaviruses.
And what are those breathing holes called?
Spiracles?
Ooh. Yep, spiracles.
Oh, yeah,
good
baby.
Job.
Wow.
Job.
10 points to whomever said that.
I mean, Bob, you whipped that out like with authority, man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, some things you just know.
What are those triangle of eyes called?
The tri-eyes.
The ocelli. Ocelli. O-C-E-L-L-I. O-C-E-L-L-I.
Oh, yeah, ocelli.
Ocelli.
Sure. Yep.
All right. So we have a very, you know, mammal-centric, I think, bias when we think about animals, but.
Right.
Insects are more diverse than any other group.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know, they're very successful.
They will be here long after we're gone.
The bugs will win.
Yep.
They're going to eat us.
And we're yummy.
They think we're high in protein.
We are.
But we taste funny.
Do you think that insects are talking about, like, you know, when if the food ever runs out, we'll just convert the humans into protein? Like, yeah, we're making like flour out of them. They want to make something out of it. They want to, what do they like? What do insects like? Like pudding? I don't know. What would be there?
What?
We'll just grow fungus in their brains and turn them into zombies.
There you go.
Ooh, I like it.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
I had the TV on today, and I don't know, it was the military channel, I think. They were talking about, you know, whatever the topic was, and this person came up and said something interesting, so I grabbed it as the quote for today. Conspiracy theorists make sense of the past by creating a plausible pattern that connects events that we know of or suppose in a meaningful way. Conspiracy theories are a way to create meaning out of the chaos of our lives and of the past. And that was said by Lynette Nussbacher. She's a professor. She's a military historian. And you may have seen her on, you know, many TV shows having to do with either military history or similar related topics. And I find her to be, first of all, brilliant and fascinating. So she's transgender. Used to be male, but now is female. And just in the middle of her career as a military historian, went through the transformation, yet is still, you know, that didn't set her back. She wasn't ostracized by her peers or anything like that. She continued her study, and she's definitely recognized as definitely an authority in a lot of things having to do with military history. I just find her so fascinating and smart. And I really I stop and pause anytime that she's on the television to give her opinion on things.
Yeah, and the quote is very good, and this is one aspect of conspiracy theories. They're trying to make sense of, you know, of a chaotic world. It mm-hmm. gives us the illusion of control, the illusion of understanding, but also arranged in a certain way, you know, a certain kind of understanding. But it's very obviously it's counterproductive because it's not reality.
Yeah,
and it's not testable, and it's not connected to facts and logic. It's just sort of an insular, isolated, you know, shielded belief system.
So for her to bring that into her conversation about the military topics, I think is great. Well done, Lynette.
Cool. Yep. I like when skeptical philosophy sort of finds its way into other disciplines.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
You got it, brother.
Thank you, Steve.
And thank you.
Yeah. Next time we get together, it'll be for Nexus this weekend.
So
we'll see you all then.
Can't wait.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.